Mr. Hield, Rail 7. We're talking about after you'd crossed the Dormont Ems Canal and taken up a lager in a cloud of field. You wanted to go back to the bomb that just missed, that, you know, was very close.
As I say, it must have been, I suppose, a 500-pound bomb. And I think people were more alarmed by that experience than any other I ever remember. In actual fact, no one was wounded, and we were all covered in mud, but at least half the tank crews decided to sleep that night inside the tank rather than in the bivouac, which we normally slept at. Each tank had decided had a bivouac which could be fixed to the side of the tank. Usually, we went into Liga and slept on fixed the bivouac on the outside of the tank.
So that was like a triangle.
Half a tent, it was half a tent, and you could sit, or you could five people could sleep side by side. Sometimes you put it on the inside of the bed. But on this occasion, a lot of people actually slept in the tank. But it seemed to alarm people more than any other experience that they've had.
Now, what's the next thing you recall then? This is when you stop being with
So
you go back to A Squadron.
This is A Squadron. I was back, but that was A Squadron. We were back by A Squadron then. So, I'm always a bit vague about the order in which things happened. At first, we didn't seem to be doing very much. Occasionally, we were, I suppose, in the lead, but we. See that the squadron was in reserve, but it seems to be in reserve for quite a long time. In fact, it's.
You just said the 5th of April, you don't remember that patrol. You were third anyway in the order.
I don't remember that. The Fairs Haven, which was the beautiful bridge building, I don't remember that at all. I remember Frank Fuller being killed because Frank Fuller was an officer who had been wounded twice before. He was, in our view, an old man of 28. He was married with two children. And he was killed, and a lot of his crew were killed as well. It always seemed to be rather unfortunate. Apparently, he did try to climb out of his tank because his driver had been killed as well. He wanted to move the tank. Our own view was that if he hadn't been pursued, the one thing you shouldn't do was get out of your tank. And certainly, it's unfortunate, I suppose, that he was killed. If one of my tanks had been knocked out, I certainly was. As long as possible, got spent covered it so that nobody could get near the tank. But I don't know the circumstances in which he had been killed, but I remember him being killed. It was a shock to all of us.
Now, at this stage, you still hadn't been in much action in the sense of actual during the advance.
Well, I see from the guy on the 8th of April, there was a reference to two troops. And I remember this well. His two troop with Lieutenant Miller leading. Dusty Miller was a young officer, I think he was only 19 at the time, who came to with my troop and was under my command. And in fact, on that occasion, I had three tanks in troop, my own Norman Miller and Derek Collins as the sergeant. And he led. We had made up our minds that I think probably this young officer who's key makes a difference, that we would go as fast as possible. And apparently, from Steele Brown's diary, we did 10 miles in an hour of advance. And almost we were continuously firing the whole way with us going flat out. And on that basis, With any luck, the first tanks can get through any bazookas. Once a tank is through, they can deal with any bazookas. It makes the bazooka man's position almost impossible, having tanks beyond it. And I think that was probably the longest advance to anybody in the fighting for the Germany it did, or in the whole of the campaign. And certainly, if one went past that, provided there were no mines on the road, you could get through those things.
And obviously, there were no mines on the road.
There were no mines on the road. In fact, I never remember having coming across mines, and no tank was ever mined, although the colonel, I think, was wounded or might have been killed by a mine on the road. But we never really worried about mines. It was bazookas that were the trouble, as far as we know.
Now, during this 10-mile advance, you were firing into either side then, as you went.
If there were haters down either side, one fired, because that's where somebody with a bazooka might hide. And the problem was nobody there at all, but one can keep going. But one fired a tremendous amount of
now, it mentions a bazooka party at Bauerschaft, which held things up a bit. Do you remember that at all?
I don't remember that happening at all. It may be that at that stage we had ceased with the leading troop. I don't remember any of the problem, but it may well have been the case. But neither of our vehicles were actually bazookas.
And were there any other aspects of tactics in a thing like that? Or would you go following each other in strict line, or would you
It's on the road. Of course, one always requires infantry, and very often there would be infantry on the back of later tanks, probably squadron, well, it depends where squadron headquarters were. You want to keep them a fair way back, which is not fair to the infantry. But certainly, if you were held up by a bazooka party, you want to be able to deploy infantry pretty quickly and to weed them out, and then one can get on again. But I think that the speed was the main thing, and support.
What about the use of smoke? You mentioned smoke rounds, and I didn't actually pick up on it at the time. How did you use smoke, or did you use smoke?
Only once did I use smoke. In fact, there was some discussion in one of the South of the Border magazines about there being no smoke, but I in fact did use smoke. And we had, besides smoke shells, the 77mm, there was a 2-inch mortar attached to each turret, which could fire mortar smoke. And on a later occasion, we hear how smoke was used.
Right. Well, now one thing on the 8th of April, for instance, you yourself, Miller, you mentioned, and Sergeant Collis. Now, we haven't heard of him before. What was he like?
Derek Collis, who is still alive, he was not a fighting fortress man. He had been a territory in the Royal Tank Regiment before the war. He had been in Egypt and had driven Matildas and various things in the Middle East. He'd come back to England and converted to something like called CD tanks, which I don't understand. I think they were possibly the tanks that were to form Artificial Moonlight, but I'm not very sure. Anyhow, he told me that he joined the fighting corps because he brought up a draft from a holding unit of other rank. He was a sergeant in charge, and the holding units, the sergeants, the officers in general, I don't know where you want to go to, and where can I go, and he came to join the 5th and 4th at the same time as I did. And in fact, although he was in other troops on occasion, he thought more of my troop sergeant from then on, really, most of the time.
How was Miller settling in?
Very well. He was a rather quiet Glaswegian. He didn't drink at all. But he was quite popular. On the other hand, there are other people who sort of never did settle in. One sees other names about the case, but they never seem.
Lieutenant Spittle, we haven't mentioned him. He was four troop. He'd taken.
I didn't Eric Spittle, I remember, but he had been wounded, I believe, earlier on in Normandy. I hadn't realised that. I thought he was the arrival. There was Cameron Henderson, who joined about the same time as I did, but he never had a troop. And he finished up, he had various jobs, and I think he was just a tech agent, various things like that. And there was somebody else called McNamara, who was rather short lived.
Sergeant Robinson seems to be commanding.
That's the interesting thing. One troop was commanded by a sergeant. I had a lieutenant under my command, and a spare lieutenant in four troops. And Sergeant Robinson, there was a time when we got very short of officers, and the general feeling was in the squadron, why couldn't we make Sergeant Robinson an officer in the field? But that can't be done in the army. You can be army.
What was he like, Robinson? What made him such a good prospect?
Well, he was sound. He was solid. He knew what he was doing. You had no doubts about it. As far as we were concerned. He was as good a troop leader as we were, and we accepted that. But later on, it's astonishing how there is this shortage of officers. With Eric Spittle, the VAE was very short lived, and I don't know, and Cameron Henderson never, and John Lawrence Jones in hand, I did, and he never did have a troop.
Now, I want to ask about, I mean, shortly after this fast advance, there's this accident when Trooper Smith was killed. Mm-hmm. That's on the 10th of April. I mean, it may be that you wish to raise something before that, but...
No, I can't remember anything particularly happened. I mean, there were other advances. We were the leading troop, I think, on other occasions. The advance was always in the same way, but very often, you were only asked to advance to the next village or something like that. This one had to keep level with troops on the other side or something like that, on either flank.
What exactly happened then? Was it your tank it landed near, or was he wasn't your driver at the time, was it?
Trooper Smith was my driver at the time. It was very close to Belsen. There'd been a lot of action during the day, but we were in reserve, and eventually we went into Lega with the regimental headquarters. I don't think the other British squadron were there. It wasn't a proper Lega, it was in a sort of farmyard, and it was very close to Belsen. And we came into Lega, there had been reports of a Tiger tank about. And we were just getting out of a tank. Smith was half in and half out of the driving hatch. Still away, the co-driver, I think, was he getting out. I was half out of the turret. I think Mackenzie, my wireless operator, was sort of half out. We were just getting ready to dismount. And the colonel's tank, well, I think it was the first tank, it may have been the second command's tank, in fact had not cleared his gun. The gunner pressed the gunner obviously pressed the trigger to fire, and he fired an 8 high explosive shell. He was only 15 yards from us, which hit the tree immediately beside my tank. We were only 15 yards. I just had a tree on top of me, but Sidaway and Tommy Smith both were hit by shrapnel. The regimental second in command was hit by shrapnel.
He was just nearby, wasn't he?
He was nearby, standing on the ground.
That's Gilmore,
yes.
According to this.
And of course, nobody realised what happened. They thought, well, here was this tiger tank. It was just one of those accidents, which are very unfortunate. But actually, it was disastrous as far as the squadron was concerned, which meant that Douglas Hutchinson became second command of the regiment, and the squadron then was taken over by Desmond Stewart.
If you, perhaps not particularly. What was your impressions of Desmond Shute's performance then as second officer? Because as commander of the squadron,
all due respect to Desmond Shute, he was a very nice chap, but he was not a satisfactory squadron commander, and in fact he was replaced before we.
Well, perhaps not being too unkind to Mr. Shute, who's not here to defend. But what did you look for in a squadron commander that Desmond didn't have?
Somebody who commanded, who knew what he was doing, who gave orders that were clear, sensible orders. His trouble was that he didn't give orders. We all supported him. I mean, effectively, it was a commune running the squadron, but he can't be done. And I mean, as a later date, I was ordered to do something which really, I'm sure Douglas Hutchinson would never ordered to do in the, I don't know, in the certain way which squadron leadership member, which I don't know about. But he did, you know, nobody had any confidence in him. I gathered he joined the unit about the same time as I did, or before that. But he was very nice, great fun, but not a squadron commander.
Now, one thing that was happening is around that time, around about the 11th, 12th, 13th, that sort of period of April, was you were very close to Belsen.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of, were you aware beforehand of what was going on at Belsen and what and the negotiations like that?
We had heard of Belsen, which is more than can be said about the other sort of gas chamber. Belsen was I don't think it was particularly a camp for gassing Jews. It was just for displaced persons. I never went into Belsen, but Derek Collins said that he went into Belsen. Certainly, we stayed at Esbeck for about 3 days, and we thought we'd be very comfortable because there were nice large farms, and they were not allowed, said so we mustn't go into the farm because of the Texas, which was not very popular, and eventually there was a sort of local armistice, and we carried on after about 2 or 3 days.
Now, the next thing, there are several incidents that you've referred to, but on the 14th of April, you got to Waldhausen, which was cleared by 1 and 2 troops, with infantry, from the looks of it. Do you remember that at all?
I don't remember the roadblock at Waldheim. I remember the next incident, which is described, which is as so often happens, rather inaccurate. It's referred to by Steele Brown in his book as well, also, I thought, somewhat inaccurately. We were very much in reserve, and in fact, I was sent off for about 2 miles, I suppose, in easterly direction because of this shooting around about. Went there and didn't find anything. Came back where I started from, and suddenly the brigade's headquarters were about half a mile away then, and suddenly two hands appeared out of the ground. And looking at it, we realised this field, which is a plough field, was full of spit trenches. This was what somebody wanted to surrender. Well, there was some infantry about, but I couldn't persuade them to do anything, so I got out and hauled this poor chap, who was a 17-year-old Hungarian, out of the ground and put him on the tank. Then tried to persuade the infantry to clear these other trenches. In fact, they weren't very willing, so what I did was I drove the tank over the trenches, really to frighten them. There wasn't I'm not quite sure the tracks were on either side of the trenches, and the infantry followed and got them off the ground. That's how we got 70 or 80 prisoners. The only prisoner I had was this Hungarian, who was covered in dirt and slit trench. And as soon as we got on the back of the tank, we were ordered to move. We moved at high speed, about 20 miles, with him shivering on the back of the tank. But I think we did give him a cup of tea at some stage.
Do you remember the anti-tank gun as well?
Oh, yes, now the anti-tank gun. As in, the brigade. The brigadier was up on the hill. And suddenly, looking beyond these slit trenches, there was an anti-tank gun, which had been there for 2 hours or 3 hours. Pointing straight at the brigadier's tank. It was an 88 millimeter. But as I say, I don't think all that's attributed to me. To see a Brown, he said I was very rash to get out of the tank, but really it was so astonishing to be in this position. As I say, we got off and come back about 2 hours later, the position we left. Nobody really noticed any of these things. There were lots of vehicles, all the echelons round about.
And did you actually blow up the anti-tank gun?
No, I had nothing to do with the anti-tank gun.
No, right.
but about that time, actually, Steele Brown, he went and wounded himself by trying to blow up an anti-aircraft gun or something like that.
What happened? Do you remember?
I gather what he did was he put a shell in the breech and got his gunner to stood behind the tank while his gunner fired at him. And a piece of shrapnel hit him while he was standing behind the tank.
And what's the next thing that you remember of your experience at that time? There's a period on 16th of April where you go towards Olsen and come under heavy fire from 88.
This is where I say that. It was a lack of good leadership that this happened. I realise now we ought to go there. As a squadron, we were down, I had some infantry about, we were down below the brow of the hill. It was, I think, the most of the field had been planted, but it was spring. And we were mortared. Well, we're not too clever, this one is mortared. The Germans must be reasonably close, but anyhow, that. So then I was told to go up to the top of a hill east towards Olsen. Now, nobody told me the tactical situation, that in fact our job was to stop the defenders of Olsen coming in a northerly direction. I knew nothing about Olsen, which was a training ground for the Panzer or the SS or something like that. And I got up to the top of this hill. There may have been the odd shot fired at us, but we identified several guns in a wood, down a dip and then up a slightly on the other side, about 2,000 yards away. I think I must have four tanks at the time, because I think that, anyhow, we showed these, the front of the wood, and with perhaps 60-70 shells, and as far as we could see, we had cleared it. We couldn't see it. We couldn't see any anti tank guns left. And then, what was to happen next? And we were ordered by Desmond Shute to advance down this hill. So I said quite clearly, well, can you send a troop to support us? I didn't mind advancing down the hill, but I wanted, if something went wrong, I wanted some firepower at the top. No, go down. Well, I hadn't been told that what there was at Gibraltar. And of course, if we were stopping them advancing north, there was no point in us going south. Anyhow, went down, started again down the hill. And I suppose we got about 200 yards down. Sergeant Anderson's tank was on the left, about 200 yards to the left. Derek Collis's tank was about 150 yards to my right, slightly forward. I was going down in the centre, and I think I would have had a fourth tank and left at the top of the hill, because there's one thing quite clearly one should do. Anyhow, we got about 200 yards down, and we were fired at. I think they say that there were 388s or 275s there. I think we must have knocked out 300 of those guns at least, because we were fired a few shots, but the second shot fired at Sergeant Anderson's tank hit it. And I reported that it was brewing up. I reported so quickly that it was brewing up that the Lavrak, who was the radio operator, heard me reporting it before he got out of the tank.
What could you see when a tank brewed up?
Well, because all I could see, it didn't go up in a flare. All I could see was flames and smoke. The trouble with Sherman tanks when they were hit was that the ammunition went off, and they exploded, or the petrol went off. But there was a fire, but it wasn't a very bad fire, but there was a fire. So I'm sure I left them as well. I ordered smoke to be put down. I ordered the Derek Collis to retire. And I took a decision that I was in Linked Power Field once again. I was going to reverse up the hill, keeping the armour, the forward armour, facing the enemy. I hadn't realised quite how clearly a tank reversed it, because it got about 2 miles an hour in reverse. I worked out it must have taken about 5 minutes to get up this hill. I put down smoke. Now, and I think the tank I left at the top of the hill put down.
Now, was this with the main gun or with the little...
With the main gun and the two-pounder. And it was we kept up a pretty good smoke screen, but eventually I used all my smoke, and I think the tank at the top of the hill used all its smoke, and I used all my two-pounder. But anyhow, I reversed all the way up.
And what about the other tank?
Now, Derek Collis, he tried to turn round, and he turned into a bomb crater and stalled. So they abandoned their tank and made their way up the hill. So there, and I think, as I say, I'm pretty sure there was one other tank at the top of the hill.
Now, your point is then that there should have been a whole troop.
There should be a whole troop there.
To provide covering fire.
To provide covering fire. Because a tank can't be on the move, can't be very much. I think I had one tank out there, but it was one.